When Rick Burns finished his 14-hour documentary about New York, he thought he'd brought his film up to the present. And then on September 11th, a whole new chapter began. Rick Burns is the brother of filmmaker Ken Burns, and he co-produced The Civil War with his brother. The final two episodes of Rick Burns' New York will air Sunday and Monday nights on most public television stations. They cover the period from the Great Depression to the turn of the century, which was yet another time in which the city reinvented itself in the wake of devastation. I spoke earlier with Rick Burns and Peter Quinn, author of the historical novel Banished Children of Eve, and one of the on-air contributors to the series. Rick Burns has said that for him, the attack on the World Trade Center marked the end of New York's island fantasy.
You know, that was a phrase of E.B. White's from 1949, thinking of the specter of nuclear holocaust in the post-Second World War period. And I felt very much feel that although White anticipated that sense of vulnerability, what it took in the end half a century for it to be made real in the awful way that people imagined the planes coming over and the flames leaping up. But it took a half a century for that to come about. I think that that's very true. I think that our island fantasy of invulnerability, of a kind of, you know, what seemed to me a sort of a schizophrenic cosmopolitanism in which you can be involved in a global commercial system insofar as you get the reap the rewards of it, but you can avoid the mess and the pain and the difficulty. That's clear now that that's an illusion. And there's so many ways in which the kind of the brash, ebullient fantasy of New York has been shattered. And I'm not saying whether that's a good or a bad thing. It's just happened.
Just to take this down to a very personal level, I was trying to imagine myself into your position. You took New York on. You've created this seven-part monolith about this city, and now it's missing its final chapter. And I was wondering, actually, if there are things that come back to you that you have either portrayed in the series or said about New York that now have a different meaning, a different resonance for you.
Oh, it's incredible, Barbara. I mean, the entire film, and especially the last 4.5 hours to be broadcast this week, are filled with stories, characters, events, and themes, all of which the context of their reception changed immediately on Tuesday the 11th. I mean, usually it takes years, decades, for something that you work on to acquire through the accretion of the historical process different meanings. Now, just the shadow of a building, the image on the edge of a frame of the World Trade Center, now absolutely transforms the way in which you read the film. Obviously, we could never have anticipated that, but it's a very eerie experience for all of my colleagues and for me, and I think actually for anyone who's seen the film, to see it and see that it's now haunted as if retrospectively by the ghost of an event yet to come when the filmmakers made it, which now pervades every frame and it pervades the way you feel and think about the stories and the characters that you're being presented with. Think, for example, of LaGuardia. Fiorella LaGuardia, 2 weeks ago, felt like a little bit of a different character, a little bit of a historical figure. Now he seems like the very embodiment of our current Italian-American mayor, who has, you know, who's taken the city to his heart and been taken to the heart by so many people around the city and around the country. That is just one of literally hundreds of ways in which the story has been, the context of its reception has been shaped, reshaped.
Mayor Rudolph Giuliani comments in your film, Rick Burns, that LaGuardia took over during the most difficult time ever to be mayor and that he was the perfect person for that time. I think that's, again, one of those moments where you feel this resonating. Here, so many are saying that Giuliani is the perfect mayor for this time and this crisis in New York. It's interesting. They're such different men, but similar in ways.
They are very similar. I mean, they're both autocratic men in many ways, towering egos, terrible tempers, each of them, known for lashing out at the press and their associates, each with a fierce puritanical streak in them, wanting to sort of clean up the city, save it from the abyss of morality into which it seems to be dropping. At the same time, relentlessly honest men, New Yorkers through and through, with a deep and abiding love for the city and its people, and when the at in the toughest of hours, absolutely there, able to speak truth to people, able to provide an example of honesty and courage in the darkest of times. And it's simply astonishing. You know, there's a painting of LaGuardia, which Mayor Giuliani had put over his desk in the northwest corner of City Hall. And he's consciously thought of himself in the shadow of LaGuardia, who is his mentor. I think that what's very, very clear now is there are many ways in which both intentionally and unintentionally, he has become the successor to LaGuardia. I certainly think he will rank as one of the very greatest of mayors. I think he had a shot at that without this event. With this event, I think it's absolutely a done deal.
They're the oddest creatures, too, in another way. They're both Republican mayors, which doesn't happen very often in New York.
One figure profiled in an upcoming episode is Robert Moses, and he's the man primarily responsible for much of the urban planning in New York in the 20th century, and it was his vision of monolithic glass and steel skyscrapers and a city crisscrossed by huge highways. Peter, could you sum up for us what Robert Moses' vision for New York was?
I kind of grew up with Robert Moses' vision of New York in the Bronx in the 1950s. I remember going down in the neighborhood I was to play where they were clearing apartment buildings for the Cross Bronx Expressway. And his vision was this kind of 19th century reformist idea of clean, orderly highways, the automobile, everything under control, everything under a central authority. It's the antithesis of what New York really is. And he had this kind of modern edge to it where the automobile was the future, dispersing populations. He had no use for immigrants or poor. It was to get on with the business of America, which was going to be lived mostly in the suburbs, people who would drive in the city maybe to work. It was a deeply anti-urban philosophy.
The historian Ken Jackson has said that Robert Moses saw New York as a transportation problem to be solved and set about solving that transportation problem with a vengeance. He had a vision, a grand unified vision of, as Peter has said, a clean, orderly, flowing metropolitan region in which there was no disorder. There was no sort of complexity of sort of human function in any given neighborhoods. The industry was where it should be. The residential areas were where they should be. People had their recreational areas over here. And it all worked according to a model and according to a plan. It unfortunately was a plan which had a kind of abstract beauty and symmetry to it, but wasn't a plan that had anything to do with the way day after day a modern democratic society functions.
It was also a plan where the minorities and the poor would be segmented out to make life more orderly for everybody else. So you would build housing projects in Coney Island where people couldn't reach work. So that kind of life of the poor, where in a real city it's intermingled with everybody else, his idea was to put it in a ghetto. And, you know, it was a modern ghetto. It was vertical rather than spread out, but that was part of his vision.
I'm speaking with writer Peter Quinn, also documentary filmmaker Rick Burns. The sixth and seventh episodes of Rick Burns' series about New York airs this Sunday and Monday nights on PBS stations nationwide. Peter Quinn is a commentator in the series. He's also the author of the historical novel Banished Children of Eve. I think one of the most harrowing examples from the documentary series on New York reinventing itself after catastrophe is the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. And that was a scene of carnage that New York really had never experienced up until this recent attack. And it forced the city to confront the inhuman labor conditions in the sweatshops at the turn of the century. It caused many changes in labor laws and social welfare. Rick Burns, could you revisit for us the circumstances of the fire?
In May of 1911, really one of the worst disasters in American industrial history took place in Greenwich Village off Washington Square in a sweatshop in a factory, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, which there was a time before there were any laws regulating the workplace, regulating the conditions, whether or not regulating how many people, whether or not there could be exits, or certainly sprinklers were hadn't been heard of. And on a Saturday evening, shortly before the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory closed for the rest of the weekend, a fire broke out on the ninth floor, and the exit doors were locked, All other means of escaping the building were really rapidly closed off by the very swiftly growing conflagration. And in the end, some 144 garment workers, women, most of them quite young, almost most of them immigrants, European immigrants, were consumed in the blaze or were forced to jump out of the 8th, 9th, or 10th floor of the building to their death in the street below. With that disaster, as with the recent World Trade Center disaster, the eyes of the city and shortly after that, the eyes of the world were fixed on that. New York was the media capital already in 1911. The press rushed up, and a horrified city gathered around and watched this happen.
Rick Burns, how did the public and the city respond to the tragedy?
In a way that's both extraordinary and reminiscent of the response to the recent disasters. As terrible as that disaster was, it coalesced a community of New Yorkers in a way that people who had never come together before came together in the aftermath of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. The whole city, rich and poor, every profession, every part of the political life of the city, came together and said, we cannot allow these conditions to continue. And so out of the tragedy came both civic unity of a kind that might not ever have existed before, and also the political will and the political consensus to actually make laws, to change laws, to try to ensure that such tragedies wouldn't happen again.
Rick, you decided to change the closing credit sequence for the final episode because of the events of September 11th. Well, why'd you make the change, and why not add a segment or introduction or a postscript, or what was wrong about the tone of the ending?
You know, we'd had the end credit sequence for the last episode was, we thought, an infinitely charming sequence of talking heads. Fran Lebowitz, Spalding Gray, Calvin Butts, Brendan Gill, Donald Trump, each one sort of more irreverent, brash, and ebullient than the next. And we kind of, by nightfall on Tuesday, the 11th of September, New York did not seem like a very brash or ebullient or even very irreverent place. Those qualities that perhaps all too glibly are associated with New Yorkers had just fallen to the ground. And really, for me, the only part of the series that simply seemed absolutely inappropriate in its tone was that sort of cheeky end credit sequence, so we scrapped it, somewhat sadly. Instead chose comments from just two people, from Robert Caro, who wrote the great biography of Robert Moses, and from my colleague Peter Quinn, who's here with us today. Both those interviews had been conducted years before the events of 2 weeks ago, but what they had to say spoke to the themes, the global themes that I think are at the heart, the serious heart of the city's history, and spoke of the degree to which, if we're going to make it as a global civilization, we're going to make it in the way New York has been making it imperfectly for the last few hundred years, making it all together with all the peoples of the world here, with all races, all religions, all ethnicities, all peoples of every national origin here, and finding a way, as Peter puts it in the end credit sequence, to not blow each other up, to not wash out our differences, not deny our differences, but somehow live with our differences intact. That's the experiment that New York has been engaged in for so long. Not the creation of a homogenized culture, but the creation of a tolerant, diverse, complex, often very messy culture in which difference is celebrated and tolerated.
Rick Burns, Peter Quinn, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having us, Barbara.
Thank you very much, Barbara.
Rick Burns and writer Peter Quinn. Episode 6 and 7 of Rick Burns' documentary series on New York air Sunday and Monday nights on PBS stations nationwide. This is Fresh Air.